And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, apparently the entire country is bracing for a revolt to break out tonight. This is Election Day, November 3rd. It's also the 307th day of the year. Leap year is 308th, and it's 58 days remain until this year is over with, and so many people are going to be happy about that. Well, on this day in history, in the year 361, Emperor Constantius II dies of a fever at Mopsuestia in Cilicia. On his deathbed, he's baptized and declares his cousin Julian the rightful successor. Remember, this is the one who was so pro-Christianity, took what was considered by many to be an off-the-wall cult and turned it into the mainstream religion of the Roman Empire. In 644, Umar ibn al-Khattab, the second Muslim caliph, is assassinated by a Persian slave in Medina. 1333, the River Arno floods, causing massive damage in Florence, as recorded by the Florentine chronicle Giovanni Villani. 1468, Liege is sacked by Charles I of Burgundy's troops. 1492, the Peace of Etaples between Henry VII of England and Charles VIII of France. 1493, Christopher Columbus first sights the island of Dominica in the Caribbean Sea. 1534, English Parliament passes the first Act of Supremacy, makes Henry VIII King of England, head of the Anglican Church, supplanting the Pope in the Roman Catholic Church. See, Henry wanted a divorce, and the Pope said no. And Henry said, fine, you're out of here. 1783, the American Continental Army is disbanded. 1793, French playwright, journalist, and feminist Olympe de Gouges is guillotined. Get uppity in France, they cut your head off. 1812, Napoleon's armies are defeated at the Battle of Vyazma. Now, this was a rearguard action which occurred at the beginning of Napoleon's retreat from Moscow. In this encounter, the French rearguard is opposed to Russian forces commanded by General Mikhail Andreevich Miloradovich. And although Marshal Davout repelled the attempt to encircle and destroy his corps, the French withdrew in a partial state of disorder after suffering, comparatively to the Russians, important casualties from continued Russian harassment. Now, their defeat at Vyazma was not decisive, but it was noteworthy because of its disruptive impact on the Grand Army's retreat. Had Napoleon moved quicker, he could have taken Moscow and probably the country, but he was delayed until the snows came, and a Russian winter is not something to be treated lightly. Hitler discovered that. He only issued summer uniforms to his troops. Okay, 1817, the Bank of Montreal, Canada's oldest chartered bank, opens in Montreal. 1838, the Times of India, the world's largest circulated English-language daily broadsheet newspaper, is founded as the Bombay Times and Journal of Commerce. 1848, a greatly revised Dutch constitution that transfers a lot of authority from the king to the parliament ministers, is proclaimed. 1867, Giuseppe Garibaldi and his followers are defeated at the Battle of Mentana and fail to end the Pope's temporal power in Rome. In 1870, they would actually do that. In 1868, John Willis Menard, Republican of Louisiana, was the first African-American elected to Congress. But because of an electoral challenge, he was never seated in Congress. 1881, the Mapuche Uprising of 1881 begins in Chile. That was the last major rebellion of the indigenous Mapuches of Araucania. This uprising took place during the last phase of the occupation of Araucania by the Chilean state. And the uprising was planned by the chiefs in March of 81 to be launched in November that same year. Their support for the uprising wasn't unanimous. Some Mapuche factions sided with the Chileans and others declared themselves neutral. The organizers of the uprising did, however, succeed in involving Mapuche factions that hadn't been previously at war with Chile. But the 1881 uprising is considered the climax of the hostilities between Chilean and Mapuche factions during the occupation of Araucania. Now, just got a news break. A judge has ordered the USPS to sweep for remaining mail-in ballots in swing states and rush delivery as receipt deadlines near. All right, let's see what else we got. 1898, France withdraws its troops from Fashoda, now in the Sudan, which ended the Fashoda incident. The Fashoda incident was the climax of imperial territorial disputes between Britain and France in East Africa. French expedition to Fashoda on the White Nile River sought to gain control of the Upper Nile Basin and thereby exclude Britain from the Sudan. The French party and a British-Egyptian force, which outnumbered the French by 10-1, met on friendly terms, but back in Europe, this resulted in a war scare. British held firm as both empires stood on the verge of war, with heated rhetoric on both sides. But under heavy pressure, the French withdrew, which ensured Anglo-Egyptian control over the area. Status quo was recognized by an agreement between the two states acknowledging British control over Egypt. France became the dominant power in Morocco, which they looked at as kind of a consolation prize. They wanted to control Egypt. All right, let's see what else we got. In 1903, with the encouragement of the U.S., Panama separates from Colombia. Colombia controlled Panama, and all power rested with the Colombians. But partially as a result of urging by prominent businessmen, the U.S. supported an uprising in Panama. And if you've never been to Panama, it's an isthmus. And now it's divided by the canal. Well, the isthmus was narrow enough. We landed Marines to keep the Colombian troops from getting to Panama City. And Colombia did not want a war with the U.S. at that time. So as a result, Panama became a separate country. In 1908, William Howard Taft is elected the 27th President of the United States. 1911, Chevrolet officially enters the automobile market in competition with the Ford Model T. 1918, the German Revolution of 1918-1919 begins when 40,000 sailors take over the port in Kiel. 1929, the Guangzhou Student Independence Movement occurred. Now, for those of you who are not familiar with that, it was a Korean independence movement in Guangzhou against the 22nd of August 1910 to August 15th, 1945, Japanese rule of Korea. The student independence movement took place in October, November of 1929. It's considered the second most important Korean independence movement in the period of the Japanese occupation, with the March 1st movement considered the most important. And the student independence movement spread throughout the Korean peninsula. But it took World War II to get the Japanese out of Korea. 1930, Getulio Vargas becomes head of the provisional government in Brazil after a bloodless coup on October 24th. 1932, Panagis Saldarris becomes the 142nd Prime Minister of Greece. 1935, George II of Greece regains his throne through a popular, though possibly fixed, plebiscite. 1936, Franklin Roosevelt, re-elected President of the United States. Well, in 1942, we're in World War II. The Coley Point action begins during the Guadalcanal campaign and ends on November 12th. It was an engagement between the Marines and Army and the Imperial Japanese Army forces around Coley Point on Guadalcanal. U.S. forces under the overall command of Major General Alexander Vandegrift. Japanese run in the overall command of Lieutenant General Arakichi Ayataki. In the engagement, Marines from the 7th Marine Regiment and Army personnel from the 164th Infantry Regiment under the tactical command of William Rupertus and Edmund Seabury attacked a concentration of Japanese Army troops from the 230th Infantry Regiment. They had marched to the Coley Point area after the failed Japanese assault on U.S. defenses during the Battle of Henderson Field. During the engagement, we attempted to encircle and destroy the Japanese forces. And though they took heavy casualties, he and most of his men were able to invade the encirclement attempt and escape into the interior of Guadalcanal. As his troops endeavored to reach Japanese positions on another part of the island, they were pursued and attacked by a battalion-sized patrol of U.S. Marine raiders, who were folks you really didn't want to mess with. All right. 1943, 500 aircraft of the U.S. 8th Air Force devastate Wilhelmshaven Harbor in Germany. Can't talk today. 1944, World War II, two supreme commanders of the Slovak National Uprising, Generals Jan Gulyan and Rudolf Wiest are captured, tortured, and later executed by the Germans. 1946, the Constitution of Japan is adopted through the Emperor's assent. Even though he announced he was not immortal and the direct son of a god, his word is still law, even today. 1949, Chinese Civil War. The Battle of Dingbu Island occurs. 1956, Suez Crisis. The Khan Yunis killings by the Israeli Defense Force and Egyptian-controlled Gaza result in the deaths of 275 Palestinians. Now, the Khan Yunis massacre took place November 3rd, 1956, in the Palestinian town of Khan Yunis and a nearby refugee camp of the same name in the Gaza Strip. According to Benny Morris, during an Israeli Defense Force operation to reopen the Egyptian-blocked Straits of Tiran, Israeli soldiers shot 200 Palestinians in Khan Yunis and Rafah. According to Noam Chomsky's The Fateful Triangle, citing Donald Neff, 275 Palestinians were killed in a brutal house-to-house search for Fedayeen, and 111 were reportedly killed in Rafah. Israeli authorities, though, say the IDF soldiers ran into local militants and the battle erupted. There was never a killing to such a degree. Nobody was murdered. I was there, according to Colonel Mir Payel. I don't know of any massacre. All right. Let's see what else we've got. 1956, the Hungarian Revolution. A new Hungarian government is formed in which many members of banned non-communist parties participate. Janos Kadar and Ferenc Munik form a counter-government in Moscow. The Soviet troops prepare for the final assault. 1957, the Sputnik program. Soviet Union launches Sputnik 2. On board is the first animal to enter orbit, a dog named Laika. 1960, the land that would become the Great Swamp National Wildlife Refuge is established by an act of Congress after a year-long legal battle that pitted local residents against the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey officials wanting to turn the Great Swamp into a major regional airport for jet aircraft. 1964, Lyndon Johnson is elected to a full term as U.S. president. Got 61% of the vote in 44 states. Washington, D.C. residents able to vote in a presidential election for the first time, casting a majority of their votes for Lyndon Johnson. See, the problem with Lyndon, he wasn't called Lion Lyndon for nothing. Democratic elections, improper activity in regard to ballots has been found, and there's being found in this election. 1967, Vietnam War, Battle of Dak Tho begins. 1969, President Richard Nixon addresses the nation on TV and radio, asking the silent majority to join him in solidarity on the Vietnam War effort and support his policies. 1973, in the Mariner program, NASA launches Mariner 10 toward Mercury. March 29, 1974, becomes the first space probe to reach the planet. 1975, Syed Nasrul Islam, A.H.M. Qamaruzzaman, Tajuddin Ahmad, and Muhammad Mansur Ali, Bangladeshi politicians and Sheikh Mujibur Rahman, loyalist, are murdered in the Dhaka Central Jail. 1978, Dominica gets its independence from the United Kingdom. 1979, Greensboro Massacre. Five members of the Communist Workers' Party are shot dead and seven are wounded by a group of Klansmen and neo-Nazis during a Death to the Klan rally in Greensboro, North Carolina. 1982, the Silang Tunnel fire in Afghanistan kills anywhere from 150 to 2,000 people, depending on which account you look at. 1986, in Iran-Contra, the Lebanese magazine Ash-Shira reports the U.S. has been secretly selling weapons to Iran in order to secure the release of seven American hostages held by pro-Iranian groups in Lebanon. 1986, the Compact of Free Association becomes law, granting the Federated States of Micronesia and the Marshall Islands independence from the U.S. 1988, Sri Lankan Tamil mercenaries attempt to overthrow the Maldivian government. At President Mamoun Abdul Gayoom's request, Indian military suppresses a rebellion within 24 hours. I've met Sikh troops. You don't want to mess with them. 1992, Democratic Arkansas Governor Bill Clinton defeats Republican President George H.W. Bush and independent candidate Ross Perot in a 1992 U.S. presidential election. 1996, Abdullah Kotli, leader of the Turkish ultra-nationalist organization Grey Wolves, dies in a Susurluk car crash, leading to the resignation of the Turkish Interior Minister. Mehmet Agar, the leader of the True Path Party. 1997, the United States imposes economic sanctions against Sudan in response to its human rights abuses of its own citizens and its material and political assistance to Islamic extremist groups across the Middle East and in East Africa. 2014, One World Trade Center officially opens. It's a replacement for the World Trade Center Twin Towers in New York City. Those towers, of course, were destroyed by airplanes during the September 11th attack. A large number of births and deaths on this date in history. Holidays and observances, Christian Feast Day, is Septimus of Anati and Companions in the Greek Orthodox Church, Clydog, Christiolus, Elias I of Antioch in the Syriac Orthodox Church, Ermengol, Gladiosus of Tarazona, Gwynhale, Herbertus, Libertine, Malachi O'More, Blessed Manuel Lozano Garrido, Martin de Porres, Papoulos, Perman, Richard Hooker in Anglican Communion, Rumwald of Buckingham, Blessed Rupert Mayer, Sylvia Winifred, Culture Day in Japan, Flag Day in the United Arab Emirates, Independence Day, Separation Day is when Panama separated from Colombia in 1903, Independence Day celebrates the independence of Dominica from the UK in 78. Independence Day celebrates independence of the Federated States of Micronesia from the U.S. in 1986. Independence Day of Cuenca in Ecuador, Mother's Day in East Timor, and Victory Day in the Maldives. Well, all that having been said, let's go back to unfinished business, unsolved murders. Well, we're talking about the Atlanta Ripper, which the police continued to insist was actually make-believe. They said it was set up to be a red herring by husbands who wanted to kill their spouses. Siri's wanting to get involved in the conversation. Well, I was talking about a number of bodies that had been found in 1911. On October 21st, Eva Florence was found, and her head had been bashed in and her throat slashed. Everything about this murder said it was the Ripper. In November, another victim was discovered. Her name was Mimi Wise. And she was in the head with a rock, and her body was found dumped on a trash heap where two previous victims had been found. But in spite of the fact two previous victims had been found, the police did not keep an eye on the trash heap. If they had, they might have saved Mimi Wise. Her throat was slashed, her right index fingers cut off at the joint. Now, of course, the police immediately decided it was her husband that did it. They said he'd killed her and made it look like a Ripper murder, but they never could prove this. And at this point, the police would have arrested the Easter Bunny to keep from having to admit there was a serial killer stalking the black community in Atlanta. Well, as with so many serial killers, there seems to be a tendency to escalate the horror of the killings. Same was true with the Atlanta Ripper. On November 21st, the still-warm body of Mary Putnam was found lying in a ditch, partially covered with loose dirt. Her skull had been crushed, her throat had been slashed. And that was enough for it to be viewed as a Ripper murder, but in this case, her breast also was slashed open and her heart torn out of her rib cage and left sitting beside the body. Now, with this final gruesome act, the Atlanta Ripper was believed to have ended his killings for 1911. Now, during the first few months of 1912, though, there were five black women murdered in Atlanta. Unfortunately, due to a complete absence of records, it's impossible to tell how many of these victims were killed by the Ripper. When you can't solve them, just make the records go away. That seems to be the Atlanta police's idea of investigation. On January 12, 1912, Ida Ferguson was found stabbed to death. Immediately, when a clearly knee-jerk reaction, police arrested her boyfriend, Lucky Elliott, who was later convicted of the murder. Even though all the evidence against him was circumstantial, the police knew he did it. So he had to be convicted. They couldn't have another unsolved murder. Then on Saturday, January 20th, the body of Pearl Williams was found. Her throat had been slashed. Police pointed a finger at Frank Harvey, who had told witnesses he wanted to marry her, and if he couldn't have her, nobody else could. And if that wasn't enough, they arrested a 17-year-old by the name of Edgar Evans in regard to this murder. They never said how he was involved, but, you know, you don't question the Atlanta police. On February 15th, the body of Alice Owens was found. Some viewed this as another Ripper killing, but the police immediately arrested her husband, Charles Owens, for her murder. And he was later convicted based on what was clearly a circumstantial case. From the police and the district attorney's point of view, anybody arrested and convicted would take the pressure off from the media. On April 15th, the body of an unknown 15-year-old girl was found. Her throat had been cut, and she had been thrown in a river. May 11th, an unidentified woman was found who had been hit in the head with a rock, dragged into some nearby shrubbery, and had her throat slashed. And if that wasn't the same M.O. as the Ripper, I'll eat my hat. Now, as far as can be determined, this murder of this unidentified woman on May 11th was the last of the Ripper murders. Now, some question whether or not all the murders committed over that two-year period when the Ripper is said to be the most active are actually committed by one man. The unfortunate thing is that due to the large number of crimes committed in the black community during this time period and the tendency of law enforcement to chalk them up to the degeneracy of the black race, the investigation was ever seriously addressed the possibility that it was a serial killer attacking black women. Now, this was a sad commentary on the concept of equal justice for all. Now, in my own case that I'm very much familiar with, I was representing a black family in a bankruptcy. Senior judge took me to lunch and said, I want you to back out so my friend can take over the case. I said, why? He said, well, some people, especially the minorities, he used derogatory terms that I won't use on the air, said some people don't need to own property. They don't know what to do with it. And it's for us highly educated folks to take the property away from them and use it for its best purpose. And when I refused, he destroyed my career. Forgery was okay. Lying by officials was okay. It was all done for a good cause. Well, this next murder involved an individual who was well known to any student of the Old West. His name was Pat Garrett. Actually, his name was Patrick Floyd Jarvis Garrett, but he was better known as Pat. He was at one time or another a lawman, a bartender, an author, a Texas Ranger, and a customs agent. But he was best known for allegedly killing Billy the Kid. Various times, he served as a sheriff in Lincoln County, New Mexico, as well as Dona Ana County, New Mexico. And like many other personages from the Old West, his reported life is a mixture of legend and fact. One thing that was known for sure, he was murdered February 29, 1908, under some very strange circumstances, and that murder is still unsolved today. Now, there are many stories told about Pat Garrett's life and death. He was said to have killed Billy the Kid with a single shot to the heart in a dark room. In spite of that story, which you'll find in the history books, there's evidence that Pat Garrett actually faked Billy's death to help his young friend get a fresh start and earn himself the $500 reward promised to him by Lew Wallace, the territory governor. I wrote a book about that called The Border Escapades of Billy the Kid. Billy actually died in Silver City in the 1930s, according to the best evidence I can find. Now, what's not talked about much is that after he chose not to seek re-election as sheriff of Lincoln County in 1882, he moved to Texas. On March 10, 1884, Texas Governor John Ireland appointed Garrett as a lieutenant in the Texas Rangers. However, in spite of enjoying his duties, within a year, Garrett resigned his commission and returned to his ranch near Roswell, New Mexico. But apparently, Garrett wasn't a man who liked to stay in the same place for too long. In 1882, he moved his large family to Uvalde, Texas, where he became a close friend of John Nance Garner, a man who would one day be vice president of the U.S. Well, Garrett seemed to be very happy in Uvalde, but something happened in New Mexico that drew him back there. On January 31st, 1896, Colonel Albert Jennings Fountain and his 8-year-old son Henry vanished on the edge of White Sands area in New Mexico. Albert Jennings Fountain was a relative of mine on the Jennings side. The mystery of what happened to the Fountains has never been solved. Apache scouts were brought in to try and track the buckboard that Fountain had been driving, but to no avail. Not even Pinkerton detectives were able to determine what had happened to the man. April of 1896, Garrett was appointed as sheriff of Dona Ana County with the sole job of solving that mystery. By 1898, he'd collected sufficient evidence to make arrests and ask for warrants for Oliver M. Lee, William McNew, Bill Carr, and James Gillian. Some months before the four were captured, they were found not guilty at trial. In New Mexico, relationships matter more than evidence. Now, after Garrett killed his last bad man, a man wanted for murder by the name of Norman Newman, President Theodore Roosevelt nominated Garrett for the post of Collector of Customs in El Paso, Texas in 1901. He was one of three men known as Roosevelt's White House gunfighters. Bat Masterson and Ben Daniels were the other two. Bat Masterson, for those that are familiar with the name, became a sports writer in New York City and had a heart attack and died at his desk. Now, there was a public outcry against his appointment, but Roosevelt was adamant in his determination to appoint Garrett to the position. And as a result of Roosevelt's firm support, Garrett's appointment was confirmed by the Senate on January 2, 1902. The problem seemed to be that Garrett performed his duties as if he was a sheriff, riding roughshod over a lot of folks. Then in May of 1903, he got into a public fistfight with an employee. Both were arrested and each had to pay $5 for disturbing the peace. But the list of his enemies was growing. A steady stream of complaints that Garrett was incompetent in his job were sent to D.C., but Roosevelt was firm in his support of Pat Garrett. Further show his support for the former lawman, Roosevelt even invited Garrett to attend the Rough Rider reunion being held in San Antonio. That is actually where Roosevelt enlisted folks into the Rough Riders. In fact, it happened in the bar at the Menger Hotel, which is across the street from the Alamo. Since Garrett had never been a member of this illustrious group, it was taken as a slap in the face to his critics. Now, Garrett attended the event and even brought a guest of his own who he introduced to the president. And that guest was Tom Powers, who Garrett introduced as a cattleman from Texas. Garrett and Powers and Roosevelt were even... As usual, anybody wants to sell something finds my number somewhere. Must be written on every bathroom in town. Well, Garrett, Powers, and Roosevelt were even photographed together and three sat at the same table for dinner. Garrett's enemies were quick to point out that the cattleman from Texas was actually Tom Powers, the owner of a notorious dive in El Paso called the Coney Island Saloon. Well, for Roosevelt, this embarrassment was the last straw. He replaced Garrett with a new collector January 2, 1906. Now, losing his appointment as customs collector left Garrett in severe financial straits. His ranch near Roswell was heavily mortgaged, and when he was unable to make the payments, the county auctioned off Garrett's personal possessions in order to satisfy personal judgments against him. The total from the auction came to a big $650. With the appointment of George Curry as territorial governor of New Mexico by Roosevelt, Garrett thought he saw a way out of his financial problems. He arranged a meeting with Curry, who was a longtime friend.
Motion detected at the front door.
Curry promised Garrett that as soon as he was inaugurated as territorial governor, to appoint Garrett to be superintendent of the territorial prison in Santa Fe. Unfortunately for Garrett, Curry's inauguration was a number of months away, and Garrett needed money immediately. Leaving his family in New Mexico, Garrett came back to El Paso, Texas, where he took a job at the real estate firm of H.M. Maple & Company. He also moved in with a woman known to all as Miss Brown, who was actually an El Paso high-end prostitute. When word reached the governor-elect, George Curry, about Garrett's living arrangements in El Paso, he immediately withdrew the offer to be superintendent of the territorial prison, which left Garrett even more desperate than ever. According to people in the New Mexican town of Oro Grande, after this setback, Pat Garrett left El Paso and moved to Oro Grande, where he planned to open a store. The building he rented still stands, and it's set up as something resembling a museum about Garrett. About this same time, Dudley Poe Garrett, Pat's son, signed a 5-year lease for his Bear Canyon Ranch with Jesse Wayne Brazil. Brazil said he planned to run cattle on the ranch, but instead brought in a large herd of goats that would ruin the land for cattle grazing for some time to come. Garrett tried to break the lease due to the goat issue, but more importantly because the money for Brazil's operation had come from his neighbor, W.W. Bill Cox, and Brazil's partner was going to be Archie Prentice Print Road, who Garrett despised. When Brazil refused to terminate the lease, the matter went to court. Attempting to play peacemaker, a man named James B. Miller met with Garrett to try and work out a solution to the problem. Now, James Brown Miller was also known as Killin' Jim, Killer Miller, and Deacon Jim. He was actually a well-known outlaw and professional killer who said to have killed 12 men during gunfights. He was eventually lynched in Ada, Oklahoma by a mob after assaulting a former deputy, U.S. Marshal. After he met with Garrett, Miller then met with Brazil, who agreed to break the lease if somebody would buy his goat herd. A relative of Miller's by marriage, Carl Anderson, Adamson, agreed to purchase the goat herd of 1,200 goats. But at the last minute, Brazil claimed he'd miscounted. There are actually 1,800 goats rather than 1,200. Well, Adamson refused to buy 1,800 goats, so the deal fell through. Later, Adamson agreed to meet with Garrett in Brazil and see if they could reach a compromise. According to one story, Garrett and Carl Adamson were riding together from Las Cruces to the meeting. Brazil appeared on horseback along the way, and Garrett was shot and killed, though who did it and why remains a mystery to this day. Now, that being said, according to the story told Noro Grande, Garrett was actually riding into Las Cruces on a buckboard for a meeting and stopped along the roadside to relieve himself, as he did many times before. As he was in the process of relieving himself, somebody stepped from the trees and shot Garrett in the head. Bodies left lying alongside the road. It is agreed that both Adamson and Brazil returned to Las Cruces, where Brazil is supposed to have told Deputy Sheriff Felipe Lucero that he'd kill Garrett. Now, it does stretch the credulity that Garrett just happened to stop to relieve himself at a place where somebody's laying in wait for him. Maintained by those in Oro Grande, that Garrett was known to stop at one particular place along the road to relieve himself, so makes it appear this was a premeditated killing. If Brazil's going to make a lot of money selling the goat herd, which is the alleged purpose of the meeting, why would he kill Garrett? And why would a professional assassin such as James Brown Miller get involved as a peacemaker in this particular disagreement? Those answers were never given. Brazil's trial ended May 4th, 1909. Brazil was represented by Albert Bacon Fall, future Secretary of the Interior. The only eyewitness to the killing, Carl Adamson, was never called as a witness, and as a result, Brazil was acquitted of Garrett's murder. Now, for that period of time, Albert Bacon Fall, a very well-connected attorney politically, was a very expensive attorney. And so if all of Brazil's money was tied up in the goat herd, who financed his defense? And why was the only eyewitness not called to testify? So was the fix insofar as Garrett's murder trial? Whatever may have been the case, for a man like Garrett to be murdered while relieving himself on the side of the road was an ignominious end to an illustrious career. That case is still a mystery in New Mexico. I've been up to Oro Grande and all around that area. And that is one of the few places along the road where there were trees and brush where you could relieve yourself without making a spectacle of yourself. Well, let's turn to Hollywood for our next murder. The murder of William Desmond Taylor. In 1967, Hollywood director King Vidor took on the job of solving the mystery behind the 1922 murder of director William Desmond Taylor. And what he discovered was so explosive that King Vidor refused to reveal the identity of the killer. He took that information to the grave with him. At the time of the murder, near the part of 1922, the murder of William Desmond Taylor was a major scandal in Hollywood. Now, Tinseltown had already begun to lose some of its glamour as audiences were beginning to tire of the silent films that were pouring out of Hollywood, and there had been a number of scandals involving well-known stars. Among those were a myriad of stories of excesses and drug use, as well as the infamous rape and murder trial of Roscoe Fatty Arbuckle. Now, though the evidence was circumstantial, and much of it seemed to prove that Arbuckle had been enticed and then framed, his career was ruined as a result of the bad publicity. Religious leaders of the day, seeking to increase their own stature at everybody else's expense, began to clamor for Hollywood to be cleaned up. They thundered from the pulpits about the declining morals of Hollywood and threatened to boycott the movies due to what they called degenerate influences. And certainly the last thing that the studios needed at this point was another major scandal. Now, William Desmond Taylor was a well-known name in and among the studios of Hollywood. Originally from Ireland, Taylor, whose real name was William Cunningham Dean Tanner, had been born in the Anglo-Irish gentry on April 26, 1872. He's one of five children of a retired British Army officer and a nephew of Home Rule Member of Parliament Charles Kearns Dean Tanner. In 1890, after attending Marlborough College in England, Dean Tanner moved to Kansas, but then moved to New York, where he married Ethel May Hamilton in 1901. They had a daughter in 1902 or 3. Nobody's really sure. On October 23rd, 1908, he literally vanished from New York, abandoning his wife and daughter. His wife eventually divorced him in 1912. After wandering the country, Tanner came to Hollywood in 1912, changed his name, and established a very successful career as an actor and director in silent films. He starred in 27 movies and directed 59. By 1922, he was a major player in the world of the cinema. Well, the mystery of his death actually began February 1st, 1922. William Desmond Taylor was spending a pleasant evening at his home with silent film actress Mabel Norman. And according to Ms. Norman, the two enjoyed a quiet evening, chatting, playing the piano, and enjoying several illicit cocktails in spite of the banning of alcohol during Prohibition. You know, important people like Hollywood actors are above the law, don't you know? She said that about 7:45 p.m. he had loaned her a book she wanted to read and walked her out to her car. She insisted nothing out of the way took place. At approximately 8 o'clock p.m., neighbors heard what they thought was the sound of a car backfiring nearby. 1922, with the number of early cars found in this affluent neighborhood, a backfiring car wasn't all that unusual, just annoying. A neighbor by the name of Faith McLean, curious about the noise, glanced out a window and saw someone wearing a long coat, a scarf, and a plaid hat coming out of Taylor's house. This person saw Faith watching, smiled at her, and went back into Taylor's house. It appeared to McLean that this person, who she claimed she didn't recognize, had forgotten something and went back in to get it. Another neighbor by the name of Hazel Gillian also heard the sound of what they all thought was a car backfiring and looked out her window. She saw what she later described as a dark figure emerging from Taylor's home. Though she didn't recognize the figure, there was nothing that stood out about this unknown person. So she dismissed the matter and went about her own business. On the morning of February 2nd, 1922, William Desmond Taylor's assistant, Henry Peavy, arrived at Taylor's home. As usual, he unlocked the front door and entered, ready to start a new day in the movie business. But when he walked into the living room, he came to a screeching halt, gaped at what he saw, and ran into the courtyard screaming for help at the top of his lungs. What he'd found was William Desmond Taylor lying on his living room floor, very clearly dead. Well, once he calmed down somewhat, apparently Peavy called Paramount Studios. In those early Hollywood days, the studios controlled everything with an iron fist. And the death of a prominent actor-director was certainly something they wanted to be involved in. In fact, it was later found out that representatives of the studio arrived at Taylor's home well before the police were even called. While they generally ignored the body, other than making sure nothing was in his pockets and needed to be removed, they did search the house thoroughly for anything that might reflect badly on Taylor or Paramount Studios, such as illicit booze, love letters, or any other incriminating evidence they could find. After finishing the search, Henry Peavy was then assigned to thoroughly clean the house before summoning the police. Now, in hindsight, nobody had any idea how many people actually tracked through the house protecting Paramount Studios' reputation between the discovery of the body and the police arriving. And there were several people present in the house when the police investigators did arrive, but nobody admitted to removing anything from the home. And each expressed shock when the police eventually discovered the death had not been a natural cause. In fact, Taylor had been shot in the back with a .38 caliber pistol. Well, by the time the police began their investigation, all that could be determined was that William Desmond Taylor had been murdered sometime the night before and that robbery was not the motive. A search of the body revealed he had a substantial amount of cash in his pockets and he was wearing a valuable diamond ring on his finger. After interviewing those in the house and in the surrounding neighborhood, the police arrived at the conclusion the sound of the car backfiring that several commented on was actually the sound of the shot that killed Taylor. During her interview, Faith McLean also told investigators the individual she had seen leaving Taylor's home had been what she described as funny looking and appeared to be wearing heavy stage makeup and a classic burglar costume. She also said the figure had an effeminate walk, as she described it. This opened up the possibility that the killer had been a woman disguised as a man. Or maybe it was a woman disguised as a man pretending to be a woman. Who knows? Mabel Norman was questioned at length since she was apparently the last person other than the killer to see Taylor alive. In fact, she was initially considered to be a suspect. But police could determine neither a motive nor any firm evidence that she was the killer. In fact, it was determined he was actually seeing quite a few women, and it was decided they were more likely suspects than Norman. Police did discover that there was a possible and certainly scandalous relationship between actress and former child star Mary Miles Mintner. Taylor was 49 at the time, and Mary Miles Mintner was only 19. Everybody knew that Mary Miles Mintner was Taylor's protege, but no one could prove any illicit relationship, though Mintner routinely introduced herself to everybody as Taylor's fiance. Now, the Hollywood tabloids attempted to fabricate a steamy love affair between the two, but those who knew Taylor best claimed that Mary Miles Mintner had an obsessive but unrequited crush on Taylor that he had tried to rid himself of to no avail. She'd periodically show up at Taylor's house at all hours, clamoring to be let inside so she could be with him. Also discovered Mary Miles Mintner was possibly mentally unstable, having once tried to manipulate her family by faking a suicide with a gun about 2 years before Taylor's murder. A number of the investigators, like Mary Miles Mintner for the killing, theorizing that the person seen by the neighbors at 8 p.m. wasn't a killer, but Mary had turned up at Taylor's house much later and threatened to kill herself or Taylor unless he returned her affections. Of course, the presence of this mystery person at 8 p.m. does raise questions if Mabel Norman was telling the truth about leaving at about 7:45 that night. According to Mabel, there were only herself and Taylor in the house till she left in her limo. Nobody admitted to seeing anybody arrive, so if that's true, how did this mystery person get in the house? Then there was Mary Miles Mintner's mother, Charlotte Shelby. Described all or knew her as a rabid, money-grubbing stage mother, known to be extremely protective of her daughter. It appeared to most that to Charlotte, Mary was much more than a daughter. She was a source of income. And if she married, Charlotte would certainly lose control of Mary's fortune. It's reported she'd once pulled a .38 revolver on director Jack Kurtwood and actor Monty Blue when she thought they were getting too close to her daughter. There had been rumors that both men had indulged in romantic affairs with Mary before she turned 19. Police were especially interested when it was reported that Charlotte had once gone to Taylor's house with a gun threatening to kill him if he didn't leave her daughter alone. And those familiar with those incidents confirmed that Charlotte's weapon of choice was, in fact, a .38. In addition to the female suspects, there were a number of others that police felt had cause to want Taylor dead. He'd been working hard to help Mabel Norman kick her addiction to cocaine, and he'd offered to testify against her suppliers. Certainly, though, supplying this star with her drugs felt that Taylor was interfering with something that was none of his business. Based on this, some felt the killing had been a contract hit taken out by the drug dealers. Police also looked at Henry Peavy, Taylor's assistant, the one who'd originally discovered the body. He also had a prior criminal record for lewdness. In Hollywood at the time, being accused of lewdness was generally another way of saying that one was homosexual. However, it was finally decided a much more likely candidate was William's former assistant, Edward Sands. Now, in the case of Edward Sands, there are a number of rumors that Sands may have actually been Taylor's missing younger brother, Dennis Gage Dean Tanner, but this was never proven. And the fact that Taylor never prosecuted Sands for was considered a support for the theory that Sands was actually his brother. It was known Sands had a long rap sheet, which included forgery and embezzlement, and he was known to have used a number of aliases and, when needed, adopt a fake Cockney accent. During his employment by Taylor, he had crashed Taylor's car on a trip to Europe, been caught forging Taylor's name to checks, not to mention being caught stealing expensive items out of Taylor's home. He'd been fired 7 months before the murder and simply vanished. Primarily due to the meddling of Paramount Studios, complicated by a long list of potential suspects, the police actually never had a chance to solve this murder. Now, though there have been allegations and accusations, nobody's ever been charged with the murder of William Desmond Taylor. Should be noted that as a direct result of the murder of Taylor and other scandals of the 20s, Hollywood studios required their actors be bound by moral turpitude clauses in their contracts. Now, it was rumored that King Vidor discovered the identity of the killer but refused to reveal it, so the case could still be solved with a proper investigation, assuming that anybody had the intestinal fortitude to brave the studio's displeasure. Well, let's talk about the Camden Town murders that took place in 1907. Though this murder took place over 20 years after the last Jack the Ripper murder, there are many who believe this murder was either committed by Jack or a very clever copycat. The victim in this case was one Emily Dimmock, known to her clients as Phyllis. She was 23 years old and simply trying to make a living on the London streets around Camden Town. She'd been born into a poor family in a small village in Hertfordshire. Most of her teenage years were spent working as a maid in various households in the shire for very low wages. In 1903 or 4, looking to make her fortune, Emily marshaled her courage, took her small savings, and left her home in Hertfordshire, moving to London. Found a room in a boarding house, also allegedly a brothel run by a petty criminal by the name of John William Crabtree. And under his tutelage, she began to ply her trade in what was called the world's oldest profession on the streets of London to earn her keep. Well, she must have been fairly successful at her chosen trade, because by 1906, she was living in a flat on St. Paul's Road with her 19-year-old common-law husband, Bert Shaw. The couple hoped to get the permission of his parents to marry sometime soon. And as a condition of the marriage, Emily had promised to give up working as a prostitute and lead a respectable life as a wife and hopefully soon a mother. Now, Bert wasn't a wealthy man by any means, but he had a solid, steady job as an overnight chef on the Midland Railway. Emily apparently really did long for domestic stability. She'd spent the last 4 years earning her keep on her back, so to speak, and it was hard for her to give up her wild, restless ways. She missed the drinking in the pubs and the bright lights and the soliciting men. But she promised, if they married, she'd give it all up. Then, too, her paramour worked all night, from 4:30 in the afternoon to 11:30 in the morning. When he was home, he was tired and wanted to sleep. So she was lonely, being left all alone most of the day and wasn't getting enough attention. Temptation proved to be too great for her, and she began to step out most evenings without Bert's knowledge. She could be found in the bars along Euston Road. One of these bars, the Rising Sun, she met a glassware designer by the name of Robert Wood, owner about September 6th. During the ensuing investigation, witnesses claimed that Emily and Woods had known each other for a long time, while Wood maintained he'd only just met. The two were sharing a drink at the Rising Sun that Friday, September 6th. After Emily left, he prepared a postcard in which he wrote, "Phyllis, darling, if it pleases you to meet me at 8:15 at the Rising Sun, yours to a sender." He signed the card Alice to allow any suspicions if the card happened to be seen by Bert Shaw. He apparently mailed the postcard either Sunday or Monday and it arrived at Emily's residence on or before the 11th of September. In the interim, Emily had passed the time entertaining another client by the name of Robert Percival Roberts. Excuse me. A cook on Wednesday, September 11th. She was seen at the Rising Sun and then at a bar called The Eagle in the company of Robert Wood. On Thursday morning, September 12th, at about 11 in the morning, Bert Shaw's mother arrived at her son's home. Most sources claim that she had come to give her blessings to the marriage of Emily and Bert. But there was no answer to Miss Shaw's knocks. The landlady of the building which Bert and Emily had their flat knew Miss Shaw and led her into the common area to either wait for Bert or Emily to get home. There was no sign of Emily, but Bert arrived home about 30 minutes after his mother got there. When Bert and his mother entered the flat, they saw Emily Dimmock naked on the bed, her throat slashed from ear to ear. Blood from her wounds actually covered the walls. Forensic examination later determined she had been murdered in her sleep sometime between 3 and 6 in the morning. The ensuing examination also revealed that though the flat appeared to have been ransacked, nothing had been taken from the flat except Emily's keys, so that let out robbery as a motive. Most of Emily's postcard collection was scattered on the floor. Two of Bert's straight razors were found next to the sink along with a bloody towel. It appeared the killer tried to wash both the razors as well as his hands before leaving the flat and locking up behind him. Well, when details of this murder were made public, there was a general hue and cry due to the fact that many of the details are very similar to those from the Ripper killings. In fact, the media coverage rivaled that given to the Ripper killings in 1888. The story had all the things that made an editor salivate. A beautiful young victim, lots of sex, and many salacious details about the sordid underbelly of London society. Naturally, suspicion fell almost at once on the glassware designer, Robert Wood. The evidence seemed to prove he was the last one to see Emily alive. Bert Shaw came across the postcard Bert had sent to Emily, and once the tabloids published a picture of the card, the handwriting was immediately identified as Robert's by his ex-girlfriend, Ruby Young. And if this wasn't enough to cause trouble for Robert, Ruby also told police that Robert had come to her and asked her to tell the authorities that still saw each other on Monday and Wednesday evenings. Based on this information, under pressure to make an arrest, Robert Wood was arrested for the murder of Emily Dimmock. Frankly, under the prosecution's theory, the case was very straightforward. They claimed on the evening of Wednesday, September 11th, Emily met Robert Wood, his planet, the Rising Sun, had gone to the Eagle, where they were seen by multiple witnesses. After this, according to the prosecutors, the couple had gone to Emily's flat where they had sex. Emily fell asleep. For some unknown reason, Robert killed Emily by slashing her throat. He searched the flat for the postcard he had sent her, and failing to find it, let himself out and locked up with her keys. Well, the evidence against Robert continued to pour in. Emily's former landlord, John Crabtree, came forward to claim that Robert Wood used to visit Emily all the time when she lived in his boarding house. This, of course, contradicted Robert's statement he only just met Emily on September 6th. To make matters worse, a number of other witnesses came forward to say that Robert and Emily had been seen together many times prior to the 6th of September. Neighbor of Emily's by the name of Robert McCowan claimed he had seen a man in the street near the Shaw house a few minutes before 6 on the morning of the murder. Unknown man had a very odd gait, left hand held stiffly in his pocket, right hand jerking in time to his right foot. According to the authorities, this was the same gait as that of Robert Wood. All this evidence, coupled with Ruby Young's testimony, Robert tried to use her to manufacture an alibi, made his conviction for the murders all but certain. Then there's an old saying, don't count your chickens before they hatch, and the same can be said for murder convictions. Defense raised a number of issues that began to make the case look less than certain as to Robert's guilt. First off, Emily got a letter in the mail. Odd enough, she burned the letter after reading it. Investigators found only a few scraps when they examined the ashes in the fireplace. Robert Percival Roberts, another of her clients who had admitted he'd spent 3 nights with her prior to her death, said she'd shown him the letter before she burned it. It was addressed to Phyllis, her professional name, wanting her to meet me in the bar of the Eagle at the Camden Town 8:30 tonight on Wednesday. It was signed Bert. Now, Emily's common-law husband was named Bert, but he was never a suspect in the murder. And if he wanted to meet her, he could meet her at home. Finally, at 8:30 in the evening, he was still at work, and there's no evidence he took the night off. Well, a number of witnesses came forward. Patricia Cornwell, a writer, wrote a book not only accused a man named Sickert of being Jack the Ripper, she alleged he had killed Emily Dimmock as well. Well, maybe it was Jack the Ripper, maybe it wasn't. Certainly proving that Walter Sickert was Jack the Ripper and committed the Camden Town murders would be a major feather in the investigator's hat, but it would take a thorough forensic examination, which might reveal some clues that haven't been previously revealed. I guess you have to ask yourself, who might know the answer to all these questions, and the only one I can think of would be the Shadow. Well, until tomorrow night, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.